From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Telling it as it is, Damian Richardson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
So, welcome to the show on Wednesday, the 29th of March. Wednesday, as I said, Ukraine is not the only place in the world having problems with its internet connection. I believe there's some problems indeed on the Gold Coast, but as they say in the classics, the show must go on. And I trust that I'm broadcasting live and loud and clear to everyone that's tuning in on this rather rainy day in Melbourne, I might add. It was, look, it was pretty interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to my producer and we decided, oh, it'd be great to talk to this Kelly J. Keene, a.k.a. Posey Parker. She's coming out to speak about women being, you know, let women speak, as obviously it was the title of the tour she had. And it was problems at that point in time with the Palaszczuk government in Queensland were had passed legislation where men were allowed to self-identify as women, not needing to undergo any transition or anything. You could just self-identify as a woman and then legally enter female spaces. And when we got to talk to Kelly J, I don't think we realised the furor that, well, not us so much, that she would be walking into. And then it was great to be able to talk to her yesterday and just sort of make a plea to try and talk without rhetoric and talk with some sort of truth, because I know I see the word misogyny bandied around. I've seen the word misogyny bandied around since, again, I say since I went to university. And, you know, I didn't learn of the antonym to misogyny, which is misandry, until much later in life. I'd actually finished university, had a long left university, when someone suggested to me there was such a thing called misandry, and I had absolutely no idea what it was. Until they explained a situation that happened to me, and they said to me, oh, there's this book called Legalizing Misandry, written by a woman and a gay man, people that should be in alliance, of course, with feminism, but not people that were being critical of feminism. And this book is about, you know, from public shame to systemic discrimination against men, and how the legal system has been so affected by misandry, ultimately, under the Trojan horse of feminism. So when Kelly J suggested to me that women disrupting the Let Women Speak event in Melbourne the Saturday before last were suffering from an inverted misogyny, that they'd taken on board an internalized misogyny is what I should say, I thought, hang on a minute, why aren't they just, you know, suffering from misandry? They just hate women. And she said, oh, that's ridiculous. Like, you know, how could they're women. They can't just be hating on other women. Well, why? Women can be misogynists and have an inverted misogyny. Why can't they have an inverted misandry? And this, you know, can go back and forth and back and forth, ad infinitum, that argument. And whilst I'll admit there was definitely men, particularly in Auckland, that were really hostile and brutal, and that's the danger, obviously, for women. They are not really frightened physically of other women, but physically men's presence is obviously threatening to them. But it was good to decide that really all of it ultimately is an attack on the traditional family and the invitation of the state to interfere in the affairs of the traditional family. And I'd say it's an attack on biblical understanding. And they say, oh, no, that's just sexism. Misogyny is something far worse. Well, I don't think so. And I don't agree with that. And I was at a service on the weekend and the pastor was talking about the important role of the male in the household, as the male, as far as he's concerned and his congregation are concerned, is still the head of the household, and the responsibility that comes with being that head of the household. I found it difficult to listen to because I felt like something else has happened, and I thought it was a really worthwhile sermon, but I think that something else has happened in the culture, that feminism has since happened in the culture, and that's been undermined, that doesn't exist. It's almost impossible to operate like that anymore in the real world. And so you've got to ask yourself, what place does it have anymore Is that the reality of the world we inhabit, or is there another reality as well? Where now, since the advent in Australia, particularly the Hawke government appointed the first ever sex discrimination commissioner in 1984, and there's quotas on female representation in the parliament as far as the Labor Party is concerned, and they put lots of pressure on the Liberal Party to follow suit. The Liberals try to resist it, but the culture demands that they do it anyway, and so they might resist it in statistically in putting it forward as a policy, but culturally they're still very much affected by it. And I was reminded of this this play by Aristophanes, a Greek play called The Assembly Women, or Women in Power, or Women in the Parliament. And the plot is Athens, and women assume control of the government, and they institute reforms that ban private wealth. They ban private wealth and enforce sex and equality for the old and unattractive. And it's a satire. Of course, it's a satire, but it says a lot about where we're at. And is there a role where, because feminism has demanded equality, and so women should be given a rightful access as the second sex, the sex that can't compete with men because of biological reasons that take women out of the workforce, et cetera. So they should be given free access to the parliamentary process. But along with that came socialism, waves and waves and waves of socialism. And I think that's one of the things that we're certainly struggling with now. And there's a couple of people, they're men, I've talked to women, I'm going to talk to some men today, a couple of guests I've got coming on the show that might even be able to further this conversation. At TNT Radio, we never go home. We're committed to bringing you our take on the biggest topics of our time. We broadcast live 24/7 online, globally, no matter what. We've got you covered on TNT Radio.
Breaking down the headlines.
It's the news I trust.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The Australian Albanese government is one step closer to fulfilling its election promise to establish a national anti-corruption commission after the Senate passed Labor's bill with amendments by the Greens. TNT Radio news producer Jeremy Beck has details on this story. Jeremy.
Thanks, Damien. This legislation passed the Senate last night, and it will create a body that will investigate corruption on a Commonwealth level, including by ministers and parliamentarians. Justice Paul Brereton has been appointed as commissioner for the National Anti-Corruption Watchdog, which will begin its operations from the middle of this year. The Liberal National Coalition supported the Greens' amendments to expand the power of the National Anti-Corruption Commission Inspector, and the bill will now return to the House of Representatives. The Greens and other crossbenchers were unsuccessful, though, in their attempts to amend the legislation to remove the exceptional circumstances clause for the public hearings and require the government of the day to gain the support of at least one non-government member of the National Anti-Corruption Commission Oversight Committee to approve the appointment of a commissioner or inspector. Greens Senator David Shoebridge says the successful amendment would give the inspectors significant additional powers to guard against potential overreach and maladministration by the commission. The Greens wanted to require a simple majority of members on the oversight committee to agree to an appointment of a commissioner or inspector to ensure future governments would not have total control over appointments, but the amendment was voted down. They accused the government and the Liberal National Party of colluding together, and of course they both have the numbers to ram anything through between the major parties. It'd be interesting to see where this goes, Damien.
Indeed, it will be. Is this just another commission to look over everything? Is this anti-corruption commission actually going to achieve anything?
I hope it would, but I'm not going to hold my breath at the same time. I think it's a good idea in principle, but at the same time, so many bodies have overseen so much hideous corruption, and it's just got swept under the rug. And I'm afraid that that will happen again with this commission. Hopefully, it can still uncover things. I've seen royal commissions, for example, that nothing really much happens of them, and I've seen so many inquiries, and it just happens over and over again. Now, the separation of powers is a good idea, where you have complete separation between the major powers, whether it's the legal system of the government or the church. And if this corruption commission is as separate as possible, and I'm not too sure how that will work, or is it, I think that will be an important thing.
The separation of powers is a fiction. It's an impossibility. Power coalesces in a center always. It cannot have another power in opposition to it. It will always coalesce. Who, Jeremy, is going to watch the watchdogs? Who watches the watcher?
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I've always said that how can you be sure that they will uncover the corruption? Because, you know, it can be like the fox guarding the hen house. And, you know, as I said, I won't hold my breath, but we can't give up. We can't be too cynical and too pessimistic or nothing will ever happen. We've found in the past power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But I tend to look also at the good side of human nature, and hopefully there will be enough people within this new commission to uncover some rot and move forward. You know, uncovering this and having real, genuine justice.
I reckon there's people to disagree with you. I think Daniel Andrews would be sitting quite comfortably with IBAC that they have in Victoria, which seems to investigate him and never comes up with anything. But I think Barry O'Farrell, who was the New South Wales Liberal leader not so long ago, got found a foul of ICAC over a bottle of wine, I believe, so it was no longer the Premier. There's going to be political interference by this body overseeing it. And and Gladys Berejiklian herself found herself in some trouble in front of ICAC. I can't remember exactly what it was, but her boyfriend has done something which obviously wasn't quite up to what would be accepted of the Premier's boyfriend.
Yeah, and these sorts of incidents will happen, and they happen all over the world in any jurisdiction. It's always a concern, but once again, if we don't have any bodies, any institutions, no government, well, then I don't think the world would be much better either. I think it'd be much worse. We do need some kind of governing bodies, but they need to have proper oversight.
More deep state. Well, we can't get out of it. No matter what, we get deep state. Jeremy Beck, news producer, thanks so much for that story. You're listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
America is just about ready to be officially declared a banana republic. This is the kind of thing that goes on in third world nations. Right? I mean, this is absurd. The left takes it as a matter of an article of faith that Donald Trump's a criminal. So,
Donald Trump's a criminal! They demand it!
Well, what are his crimes?
He's a criminal.
I mean, it's like talking to these morons from Idiocracy, right? 45% of this country believes that Donald Trump is a criminal. This is an article of faith. They don't know what his crimes are, but he's a criminal. He needs to be in jail. Meanwhile, this is nothing more than the most massive case of psychological projection ever. Hillary Clinton, multiple felon. I mean, we could recite them. We all know them. The bleach pit, the 33,000 emails, the destroying this, the private server, the destroying the hard drives and the Blackberries with a hammer, the everything, right? Multiple felonies. We've got Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, James Biden, Haley Biden, and now potentially the niece. Multiple felonies, right on up to and including selling the office of the Vice President of the United States of America to China. But Donald Trump's a criminal. It's an article of faith.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
In the past, people thought if you had a mental health problem, you would never feel better. You might meet people who still feel this. Maybe you feel this way about yourself. Mental health is just like physical health. Everybody has it and needs to look after it. If your feelings, thoughts, and reactions are getting in the way of how you want to live, if you feel things aren't right, if you feel like you need help, you can ask for it. We're not going to pretend it's easy. Mental health problems can change your life, and for some, they can be overwhelming. But that's why Mind is here. We're going to face it with you. We'll listen, give support, and fight your corner. To find out more, visit mind.org.uk.
A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
And now, political observations from the late Stephen Hawking.
We boldly go where no man has gone before.
What do the stock market, Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, have in common? They are three things that are about to crash.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My first guest this hour is a return guest. It's Father Chris Yates. Father Yates is a priest of the Catholic Apostolic Church in Australia, a branch of the Brazilian Catholic Church. Originally from Manchester, he was a policeman for 10 years in both rural Oxfordshire and in London. Chris was a Church of England priest who trained in Oxford before coming to Australia in 2010. During his transition from Anglican to Catholic, he worked as a policy advisor to two Australian senators, an occasional contributor to the Spectator Flat White. Chris has studied theology and philosophy. He has a keen interest in politics and economics from a philosophical point of view. Chris is married to Jennifer and they have five children between them. Father Chris Yates, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Now, can I set a scene for you? And I'm going to ask you a question about the state of the world where we're at. I did an editorial, and this is part of the editorial, but I'll go into more detail than I did on the editorial. So I'm at church on Sunday, and the sermon with the pastor is about the from Genesis. And now it's Abraham and Sarah. Now, God has appeared to Abraham and told him at his ripe old age, I think he's over 80 by this stage, that he's going to have a child. Bear with me. It's all going to be good. He tells Sarah this is what's happened, but Sarah's 75. She's thinking, come on, you're kidding. There's no way I'll be bearing a child at this age. So why don't you sleep with our servant? She's younger, you know, attractive young woman, loyal, Hagar. And Abraham doesn't argue with his wife and he sleeps with her, and hence the problem starts from that. Now, what the pastor was getting at was a problem of male leadership. He was saying to the congregation that just because your wife suggests that or even thinks that's a solution, she's trying to help you fulfill prophecy, and maybe it's because it's not just lasciviousness. He's thinking, oh God, I don't want to argue with the wife. For whatever reason, he says yes to it. And the problems with male leadership. And it was a really good sermon because he wasn't afraid to go there. And quite often I used to go, and I've told you before, I left the Catholic Church because I wouldn't have got that sort of a message, but I would have been quite grateful because my marriage ended. So I felt the pain and I'm there with my children. And I'm going, oh, that really, really, really hurts. But I thought what was missing from the sermon, now it's important, I understand this is complex because it's important that he tells his congregation that, because there's no point him telling the congregation something else or taking on the you know, secular world, bringing it inside the church. But I think what you miss is progressivism has destroyed that traditional family, hasn't it? That family doesn't really exist. It may exist in the exception, but it does not exist in the rule. And part of the culture I've been part of certainly did not defend my marriage. As a matter of fact, I was quite happy to let it be destroyed.
Yeah, I think, well, that's all part of why we often people like you and me appeal to classical liberalism as the sort of ideal way of conceptualizing our place in the world. You know, John Stuart Mill famously wrote his book
On liberty,
but on liberty. So, but the real problem we've got in our present age is that all of the institutions that existed and were strengthened in that period, things like I'll say the church, and I mean that in the broadest possible sense, things like the church, things like the family, things like male and female identity, all of those things have been deliberately targeted and undermined. I mean, this is the sort of this is the claim that we make against the neo-Marxists, the people in the academic institutions who seem to spend all of their time talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, arguing with judges in America who they invite to campus and then attack. These institutions have been fundamentally undermined, and therefore when we appeal to a classical liberalism, it actually doesn't knit with the world we live in. Now, that's by design. The people that want to undermine freedom do that on purpose. But I think one of the challenges I'm giving myself is to say, well, how do we what's the on liberty for our generation? Because even though I agree with John Stuart Mill, there needs to be a different tactic employed in our own age, because those institutions have largely vanished, especially in the West. So that's why I think, though I'm temperamentally libertarian, I think there needs to be a sort of, I don't know, a way back to a traditional understanding of the world in order to move beyond this rampant progressiveness, which has completely undermined all of our institutions. You just mentioned before I came on the show, you were talking about this federal ICAC, you know, and this is like many of those other bodies, like when Tony Blair became the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom and gave the Bank of England freedom, quote unquote, other words, removing the political process from the raising of interest rates and what have you. And this was seen as a great, wonderful thing because we've handed it over to these experts. Well, it was a terrible thing because what we did was we removed them from the electoral ballot as a consequence of their, of what they did or didn't do. It should be an elected person that ultimately takes responsibility for those things. And so, you know, you mentioned a federal ICAC. The only reason we're talking about a federal ICAC is because other institutions have you know, apparently failed. I don't think they have, actually. I think this is largely a political hit. If you look at how ICAC's been employed in New South Wales, it's been largely to get rid of people they didn't want. So, but really, if you have a functioning judiciary and legal system, you don't need a federal ICAC. It's actually the job of the police to investigate corruption. That's a police matter. And of course, for something to pass the threshold of the police investigating something and bringing something to trial, that's a very high bar. It's that way by design and on purpose. And because, in fact, you know, we're not supposed to capriciously be able to destroy someone's reputation, let alone their career. These two points are connected because we've had that attack on those institutions. Nobody can trust anything or know, or have any confidence that there's competency at the heart of these institutions. Therefore, the tendency is to replace them. And a federal ICAC essentially replaces the work of the police and the judiciary.
I mean, doesn't this become another bureaucracy that's going to be corrupted? Because I know before in the news, and Jeremy was talking about the separation of powers, which is something I'd say as well. And as an ideal, of course, that the powers should be separate. But the reality of politics is powers are not separate at all, because power will not allow something else to operate and power as converse to it.
Well, actually, I mean, the separation of powers is for the birds, as far as I'm concerned. I think you said it doesn't exist, and I think you're right. I don't think it's ever existed. Like all the worst ideas, it came from France. And so the French really
tried. You're not allowed to say that as an Englishman.
Especially speaking from Dublin in Ireland at the moment. The separation of powers actually doesn't function, and we don't have the separation of powers in the Westminster system. I would argue the USA, you know, has on the face of it a more separated and the separation, by the way, is between the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. It's not the church, actually, although it's confused because in France, of course, the church was part of that system, and so they were kind of removed, and what you had left was the left. That's where the term the left comes from. But in America, even they don't really have a separation of powers. I mean, you know, when was the last time the legislative body really came up with any ideas? All executive action in the USA. In the Westminster system, the executive sits within the legislative, you know, because the prime minister and the ministers, and this is true in the states as well, the premier and the ministers, sits within the legislative chamber. This separation is for the birds. It's a myth, really.
So did the church do itself a disservice when it even accepted the fact that there should be a separation of powers?
I'm a firm believer in the separation of church and state. If you look at what's happened to the Church of England, which is the state church in England, all that's happened is the state has eroded the church, which is why you get the Archbishop of Canterbury last Easter. Be interesting to see what he does this Easter. Last Easter, on Easter Sunday, he preached about the migrant crisis. So I'm not sure whether Jesus got a mention, you know. So
Jesus is optional.
Yeah, that's right. So what happens is the state actually completely infiltrates the church. Of course, it's bad if it happens the other way around as well. You know, I don't want to live in a theocracy, although I believe that the truths of the Catholic faith, I don't believe that our laws should imprison people for not going to Mass on Sunday. You know, I think those are moral decisions, and that's where we have, that is what a healthy separation recognizes.
Haven't we ended up with a progressive form of religion, a zealotry now, because the church has vacated that space, that moral space?
Yeah, it has vacated it. It's also been thrown out. You know, both of those things are true. I think what we have now is a cult. It's not a true religion in as much as it's far more insidious than that. So, you know, we have this cult of identity where everything's about me. Who do I think I am? And it's gone to such a radical point of view that you can argue with nature itself, you know. Or, I mean, the claims of secular people to say I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, you know, that's a metaphysical claim. That's, you know, that's not scientific. That's not rational. That is a metaphysical claim. That's it's kind
it's
of
an
a
article
spiritual
of faith.
Claim.
And so
the very people that would reject any notion of the public discourse of God or of the existence of angels and demons have just taken wholesale and gone along with this idea that somebody who has, you know, a mental illness, if we were talking to somebody with schizophrenia who said the radio was talking to him, we wouldn't say, yes, the radio is talking to you. What is it saying? You know?
That would
in fact be criminal neglect if you were a mental health care professional. And yet, apparently, not all, of course, there are many healthcare professionals that want to fight back on this. And what's happening? Well, look, in Canada, they're changing the law to say, unless you affirm this, you're going to have your license removed. In other words, if you do your job properly, we'll sack you.
So there's power, consolidating power again, which is exactly our point, I believe. And I'm just going to go to we'll be right back. You're listening to TNT Radio.
What do they want?
Exciting news.
Brace yourself.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. It's been revealed the transgender man who went on a shooting rampage at an elementary school in Tennessee, killing six people, including three children, had amassed a secret cache of weapons at his home, despite being diagnosed with a mental illness. Ukraine is struggling with internet connection issues after many of Elon Musk's Starlink terminals suddenly stopped working. And Russia's blasted Washington for its hypocrisy after the US State Department condemned Moscow's move to deploy nuclear weapons to Belarus.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Father, is the enfranchisement of gay marriage and marriage equality undermining traditional marriage?
I think I wouldn't even call that the tip of the iceberg, really. I think that the undermining of marriage happened a long time before. You know, very well, I speak to you as someone who's also divorced and remarried.
Yes.
And so now I accept, look, we're also trying to solve the problem of human sin. I mean, this is why, you know, people of faith do in fact have an explanation for the fact that these things don't always work. The problem is flesh and blood human beings who are sinful, me included. But I think the undermining of marriage has more fundamentally been done by, you know, the insistence on women having no role unless they've got a job. That sort of, you know, an identity as somebody who has a job is more important than the identity of being a mother. And this puts strain and of course, you know, economically speaking, as soon as that begins to happen, well, it's very hard for women to withdraw from the workforce to look after children, even if they want to. And so I think we've been seduced into into thinking that the good life is having a meaningful career where,
so Father,
you know, it's more, yeah.
Sorry, no, I just wanted to ask you something about that because you've brought up your divorce and I was going to try and find a way of bringing it up. So I'm so glad that you did bring it up. And I've talked about it in my own circumstance as well. And I've talked to you about the sermon I heard, which was a really powerful sermon and important sermon. But boy, boy, it hurt. And it, I felt disenfranchised by it, for want of a better word. How do you reconcile your first marriage failed or divorced and now being a Catholic, how do you reconcile it?
Well, I don't. I think this is the problem with a sort of hyper rationalism, is that we think that we've got to account for everything under the sun. That, like I said, I account for it by saying that I'm a sinful person, and therefore, you know, the answer really is in the it's in the scriptures, it's in the man creating the image of God and his restoration to God, not through his perfection, not through his ability to toe the line and be the perfect obedient person under the law, but actually being willing to submit to that vulnerability to you know, throw that vulnerability at the foot of the cross of Jesus Christ, who was the perfect man. And so the only way is to say this is about forgiveness and reconciliation. Now, that doesn't mean that the past is erased. I think that it's a big mistake for people to, well, people say forgive and forget, don't they? It's absolute nonsense. Forgiveness is not about forgetting. Forgetting is amnesia. Forgiveness is actually about being aware of the pain, being having that total awareness of the responsibility that we bear for having harmed other people, or having been harmed, and then, like I said, surrendering that to say, well, but there is a better and more perfect way, and forgiveness is actually about letting go of that vengeance or that desire to think that we can put everything right ourselves, because actually we can't.
Do you account for that?
For when we can't put things right.
Yeah, if you were going to give that sermon that I've talked about, would you account for that in a sermon?
Yeah, I mean, I think also, I mean, the most important message of the relationship of Abram was in fact that it was about God's faithfulness, and you know, when God said he's going to do something, he does, because God is perfect. And so and it's actually about the children that are produced. Yeah, that's right. And so it's a lesson in saying, well, you know, forcing God's hand is not good for you or anybody else. And then, of course, you know, it's about God saying, I'm going to take this absurd situation to old people, well past childbearing age, and from them raise up a great nation. And in a way, it's a kind of hyperbolic story to emphasize the greatness of God and the fact that God will bring about what he wills. Now, that doesn't mean he goes against our free will. Again, that's within the story. But in other words, that our human frailty and our tendency to try and be like God, which is what the book of Genesis is all about, the fall is about, the temptation is to say, eat from this tree, you'll be like God. Abram, before he's Abraham, of course, Abram is in the same dynamic of essentially trying to bring about what God wants, you know, forcing God's hand. So it's the sort of superstructure of that story is to say, no, in fact, God will, despite us, God will bring about his purposes, but it will include us learning along the way.
Father, what do you think of, IVF? So, because I know there's an ad, I hear this ad sometimes when I turn the radio on, imploring men to donate sperm because there's women that have got everything in life, they've done everything, but for whatever reason, they just haven't met the right man. And how could that be their fault or the man's fault, you know? So why don't we just get around that? Gentlemen, step up, do your duty and provide sperm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's It's interesting, you know, I did a show in America earlier this morning in terms of my time, and that question came up there as well. It was in a very different context.
Already?
So it's interesting. Damn, that prepared. These things are coming up. but I think that clearly the best unit for the raising of children is within a family. Now, things can go wrong with that. You know, people do die in childbirth still. But, you know, so it's not to say that this is the only way. I think there's a tendency for people to say, oh, the church says this, but they're out of touch with reality. No, there's not about being out of touch with reality. For me, there's two major problems with IVF. One is the fact that if it's being used in that sense, to having, you know, a woman alone having a baby, I think there's a huge problem with a child being raised up not knowing his father. I think we all know, have seen the problems that that creates. The other problem with IVF, of course, is it creates more than one embryo. And what happens to those other embryos? They're just put on ice or thrown down the sink. This is a moral question. I'm not interested in making moral things against secular law, but I would never encourage anybody to go down that process. I mean, I know it's a very expensive and risky way of doing it, but there are ethical ways of using IVF in terms of creating one embryo and implanting one embryo. Now, the scientists will tell you that's a very inefficient way of doing it, and they're right. But it is a more ethical way of doing it. There are more efficient ways of running everything, but they wouldn't be very ethical.
We know there was a particular group mid last century that were pretty efficient at running lots of things.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that's right. And we end up getting into eugenics and everything else. So for me, IVF has got a double problem. I think there is a vast difference between a married couple who are seeking to have children using IVF and somebody who has, no one's allowed to say these things anymore, but if somebody is single and a career person, are they very well prepared for being a parent?
Well, that's the choice they've made too. We haven't even gotten on to surrogates for same-sex couples yet. We're not going to get there though, Father, but we will talk again. I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks for coming on the show.
Me too. Cheers, Amy.
Thanks, mate. You're listening to TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Once again, the media got way out over their skis.
We've got that drumpf now!
And then once they find out, maybe not, they've got to distract. So we have to have a school shooting and not one, but two train derailments. The pattern has become so unmistakable as to almost be a cliche. Anytime they've got bad news on the horizon, they need to distract people from the truth. We have a school shooting. We have an airplane flying into a food processing factory. We have train derailments and associated environmental disasters. We have anything big and flashy and bloody. If it bleeds, it leads. Meanwhile, Stumblebum Joe yucks it up with kids in the East Room when he's supposed to be addressing the school shooting, leaving it to Corinne Jean-Pierre to voice the plaintive Democrat refrain, "How many more children need to die before Republicans pass the assault weapons ban?" Even though the previous assault weapons ban passed in the Clinton administration not only didn't save any lives, it cost lives. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And unfortunately for America, we're seeing all too much of it lately. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
While the mainstream media peddles fear, thousands of prominent scientists are speaking out despite a near blackout in the mainstream media. For example, Clintel was founded in 2019 by Emeritus Professor of Geophysics Gus Berghout and science journalist Marcel Kroc. This global network of 900 scientists and professionals make the point that CO2 is not a pollutant. It is essential to all life on Earth. Photosynthesis is a blessing. More CO2 is beneficial for nature, greening the Earth, Additional CO2 in the air has promoted growth in global plant biomass. It is also good for agriculture, increasing the yields of crops worldwide.
If you're talking about it,
a poem, one today, says, "And always one moon, like a silent drum, tapping at every rooftop and every window on every Let me start this over again.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Joe Biden makes George Bush Jr. sound good. Remember that George Bush Jr. did that thing? What was it? You know, fool me once and fool me twice. You know what I mean? Well, Biden makes that sound like a veritable Shakespeare, as will my next guest. He's got a Shakespearean voice, there's no doubt about it. And it is a return, of course, guest to the show, John McBride. He grew up in an active Labor Party family. He gave up on the ALP after Keating's last term, which was too woke for him. John joined the Democratic Labor Party in the early 2000s, a party which were at least ideologically opposed to cultural Marxism. He worked for a few years as a parliamentary advisor in the Victorian Legislative Council for a DLP member. And more recently, John ran as a candidate at the federal Senate in 2022, support my candidacy to be above the line on the ballot. John is currently working on a documentary about ivermectin. John McBride, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Thank you.
Good to have you, mate. We were talking a couple of days ago. It was probably all gone now. We'll just sit in silence for next 15 minutes. But about power and how it's now organised in, I'd say across the world, but let's specifically focus on Australia and maybe to start with focus on Victoria, the inability for the Liberals to actually stand or represent anybody anymore and the problems that are caused basically for that party, a party traditionally of small government, a party that once upon a time was born to rule, but a party with an absolute inability to deal with the influence and forces that affect it under this globalist system that we now operate under.
Yeah, they're a bit like a rat in the headlights, aren't they? They just don't quite know why they're there in the middle of the road. They're sort of looking for a home. I think when we were talking, we were saying that they were great up until the end of the Cold War. Previous to that, Menzies and the Liberal Party was all about representing the ruling class and the ruling culture, and they did a very good job there, and they knew where they were as far as Marxism was concerned. They were staunchly anti-communist. But once the communists failed, and a bit like Labor was after Keating had sort of succeeded in all the structural changes he wanted for the Labor movement, the Labor Party was flopping around looking for an agenda, and they adopted the woke agenda around women, and they pursued that. And that was one of the reasons I left. And the Liberal Party, to a certain extent, have gradually looked around and gone, well, where are we now? Who do we represent? And I think with that more redeeming just recently, Pesudo has come out. And said, no, we can't have people like this. They're 3 or 4 degrees separated from Nazis, and that's just not good enough in the modern Liberal Party. We'll have to expel her. And, of course, that was Monday, the party room meeting, and Pesudo got rolled. He got rolled. The best he could come up with is, we're going to suspend her from the party and take away her whip job in the Legislative Assembly. Which just goes to show the Victorian Liberal Party, like the rest of the Liberal Party around Australia, they've had a civil war between the sort of the wets and the dries, or the bedwetters and the dries, and who are they? Who do they really represent? The Pseudos faction represents the inner city east, their old stomping ground, their old blue ribbon seats, and I think more redeeming. She represents the vast majority of traditional Liberal voters who just want some common sense in their policies, and enough of the way.
It's fine for everyone to snipe at them, and I'm happy to snipe at them too, but the reality is there's no way through for them, is there, logically, because globalism is an existential crisis to the actual party itself, a party that purports to be of smaller government. well, here's this massive government sitting over everything now, these massive NGOs, managerial capitalism, which has boards elected to manage capitalism, no longer entrepreneurial capitalism, which would have suited the Liberal Party much more. And those boards, those structures sit over the party and sit over state governance now. So what can they, literally, what could they really even do?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? I suppose what you're saying is, right, the economic battles are over. You know, the capitalism supposedly won. And we thought Marxism would just sort of crawl off into the shadows and die. But it didn't, did it? It re-emerged stronger through through the women's movement. Now we're seeing it with the transgender movement. We're seeing it with ESG. We're seeing it with climate change. It's just re-manifested. And, of course, as you're right, that agenda is now controls capital. And that's the frightening thing. Before it didn't control capital the way it does now. And so that they are making economic decisions based on this stuff. But is it more insidious, Damien? Is it more insidious to the extent what is it about? I mean, some people will say, well, look, what we're really looking at here is America's the declining power. We've moved all our assets over to China, and China's going to be the manufacturing base for the world, and they'll just, through their Belt and Road scheme, they'll make it all over in China and just ship it to us in our markets, and we'll get along with being a service-based industry like Singapore or some country. I don't know how many office jobs are available in that economy, but I think they know how many jobs are available because depopulation seems to be part of their agenda too. So,
right.
So whilst they've moved it, they've then imposed upon us this sort of bizarre, you know, with the climate change, the 15-minute cities, and they're talking about digital cash, and all these measures. When you look at them, you think, well, hang on, every one of those measures it basically takes away one of my rights, takes away one of my freedoms, takes away my ability to express truth or to follow my rational thinking. They all seem designed to enslave us, not empower us, and not liberate us. And yet we seem to be agreeing with it. And that's the question that I raise. I mean, I can't be Robinson Crusoe. Am I the only bloke that knows that this is going on?
Do you know? And so these Nazis appearing on the steps of the Victorian Parliament a couple of weekends ago, and everyone's gone crazy about it on both sides of politics. They're passing laws now, or they're proposing to pass laws in the Queensland Parliament to ban the swastika, as has already been banned in Victoria before the Nazis even turned up, and the Roman salute, they're going to ban that as well. And I posit that what people, and it's not that they're scared of Posy Parker and, let women speak. It's they're scared of being associated with white identity politics, and not under the guise of the 6 million Jews, but under the guise of that the globalist structure, that the white population doesn't breed anymore, really. It's got a really static growth rate. Where our increase in population is coming from now is from other countries, more traditionally third world countries. And so the last thing anyone wants to be seen to do is to be into any sort of support of white identity politics. And I think that's why you're seeing people just run a mile from it.
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it? It's one of the fronts in the battle. Western civilization is white supremacy on steroids. Therefore, anything to do with Western civilization, which would be Christianity, which would be rational thought, which would be these ideas of personal liberties and freedom, that must be crushed. But isn't it interesting? Dan Andrews is out there and quite cleverly, as Dan can do from time to time, quite cleverly wedged the Liberals on the Nazis who were there, who were really just a sideshow to the old real argument. He's also come out and said essentially that trans rights trump women's rights, and that Nazis are evil must be banned. And then he's on an airplane off to China to probably the greatest example of a fascist country, right, where fascism is actually practiced.
But that's what's not really, that's why I say it's not really about fascism. It's about not being identified with white identity politics. Fascism doesn't matter. They're already fascists.
That's right. So if the Chinese are fascists, that's okay. But if we get a couple of blokes that jump around in black uniforms and, you know, manicured fingers, and that's evil somehow. That's terrible. Yeah. But look, I mean, just to make the point with Dan, Dan is doing what throughout history is, you know, he's turned Victoria into a vassal state to China, and he's over there to pay tribute to his masters, to the kings of that empire. And that's really, really, I think when history is written about this time period, that's how that will be described as far as Dan Andrews is concerned.
And he'll play to his power base because they can reward him handsomely, and he can bring those riches back to the population, can't he? And build another bridge or another road, or, you know.
keep financing.
Yeah.
That's right, because they've got all the money. And Albo will let him do it. Morrison pulled him up. Albo's going to let him go, obviously.
Can I ask about that? Because Morrison pulled him up, but I saw absolutely no material difference on the streets of Victoria after that point at all. None whatsoever. Did he really pull him up?
It dropped out of the newspapers, didn't it? Dropped out of media. So to what extent he pulled him up, I'm not sure.
All the projects were still being completed.
Well, they were already commitments made, weren't they? So it's really, he's going to come back with a new bag of commitments, I think, essentially. I mean, what is there anything actually left to sell in Victoria? I'm not quite sure what he wants to sell this time. Maybe it's a house, you know, you're going to get the Chinese to build houses for us or something. I'm not quite sure.
See, you know, I'd say too, the Nazi thing doesn't matter, because here we are supplying Ukraine with, I think we've spent something like $655 million in support of the war effort in Ukraine. We were the largest outside of the NATO countries. Now Japan has taken over. They have an Azov battalion, a Nazi battalion. Mm-hmm. There seems to be no problem with Nazis there, but there's problems with Nazis at home. Yeah,
it's interesting, isn't it? Why the difference? Why are we financing? I mean, there was a 2014, the United States State Department, George Soros and a few other people tipped out an elected government in the Ukraine unconstitutionally, chased this bloke away, tried to kill him. He found sanctuary with the Russians, and then took the militant arm that had forced their coup, and then put them into the military. And then from 2014 up until when Russia stepped in, they did their best. They killed 14,000 men, women, and children in the Donbass, because for no other reason than they were Russian-speaking Ukrainians, and the Nazis from the west of Ukraine didn't like the Russian-speaking Ukrainians. It was essentially a civil war. So why are we financing it? Good question.
The Hague has found Putin guilty of war crimes.
That's interesting. Yeah. It's the bureaucracy, the European bureaucracy that are financing it. Yeah, I don't think Putin's too particularly worried about those folk.
So. Where does it end? Where does this end? What hope is there? What light is there? Let's go back. We've got a few minutes before news. What hope is there for the Liberal Party moving forward? Is there a saviour amongst that party that you can see?
Oh, well, with all civil wars, one side eventually reigns victorious. I think they're diminished. What they call the dry, the right wing, the sort of the more Demings, just good old fashioned traditional liberal values. Menzies would appreciate it. Those people have been on the ascendancy for a period of time. I think the fact that she didn't get tipped out or expelled proves that she had the numbers to support her. I think you'll find that the way that the Liberals play this, and Bisciuto's not the bloke to lead the charge for the Wets. I think you'll find that within a few more election cycles, they'll have been diminished to a rather than a major brand, I think they'll be top of the miners, to be honest. Because you're really competing with Labor, and Labor does it better than they'll ever do it.
And so you think collapse is probably the best thing, is to collapse and then another phoenix can rise from the flame?
Well, I think they're diminishing. They will stay there. They will stay there as a political party. They're just being diminished. They won't have the popular appeal. There's a vacuum there, just in the sort of centre right of Victorian culture. We're a party with a well-organised party built around traditional values should step in. I mean, One Nation's trying to step in there, and LDP's pretending that they represent that group. But I mean,
but they have a problem demographically. One Nation don't. There's a demographic shift. They're going to maintain some balance of power, but they won't be able to have a broad enough appeal, will they?
No, they're a regional base. They need to be around, good old-fashioned Anglo, just old-fashioned Australians in the rural sector.
John McBride, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show. I'll talk to you next time, mate.